Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm sitting down and having a chat with Nathan Burns, who is the owner of Backpacker Medics. Now today we're going to have a bit of a chat about what Nathan does, a bit about Backpacker Medics, and hopefully just open up your minds to some different and alternative pathways that you guys can take once you finish the degree. So Nathan, thank you so much for joining today. Did you want to introduce yourself a bit?
Good morning, I guess. My name's Nathan. I'm the founder of Backpacker Medics, which is a non-profit organisation that we founded back in 2010-11. So we're almost going on 10 years. And our mission, I guess, is to take pre-hospital care to those that need it most. Predominantly worked in Nepal for the early stages of the organization, and then we changed our model in between 2017 and 2018 to now do disaster response and relief.
Awesome. So what made you want to start Backpacker Medics? How did you get that journey started?
Honestly, it came from just being a vagabond. I spent many years traveling, lived overseas for a whole bunch of years before I even started in paramedicine, and tried to continue to travel as I was, you know, doing my degree and in the early parts of my career. And I was actually up in Laos in Southeast Asia there, and I was talking to an Australian lady who runs a tuk-tuk library up there, and essentially she was going out to remote villages and taking books to kids. And then she mentioned to me that any of the kids that she found that were actually sick or needed medical help, she would bring them back to town and try and hook them up with some medical help or a hospital or any way that she could. And to me, that sounded a little bit like paramedic work. I think I was in my second year of the I guess you'd call it a graduate program now. I trained in Western Australia, so we go to uni and then we complete our degree on road. So I was kind of in the second year of that program. I was about a year off becoming a fully fledged paramedic. And I kind of had a bit of a chat to her, and I thought, oh, that might be something that I might think about returning and doing next year or something like that. So I took the idea away and I sat on it for a little bit, and I had a bit of a talk to a friend of mine who was doing a PhD on investment in Laos, and he basically persuaded me not to do it in that country, particularly because a lot of the politics and you know, the nepotism that goes on up there probably would have led me down the path of having to pay a lot of extortions and things like that to get my gear back after it had been taken off me. But he had some connections in Nepal, and he hooked me up with some organisations over there that actually wanted to do some medical projects, and kind of that's how we started. In the beginning, it was the idea was simply to be exactly what the name says, backpacks full of equipment, roaming the hills of Nepal, delivering medical care and treating people, and then transporting those that we couldn't treat in the kind of normal ambulance style, but more on foot. But the more that we worked over there and the more research that we did on the ground, the more we realized that that wasn't really a sustainable model. So although we still carry all our supplies, we were still able to access really remote areas on foot, we found that we needed to actually build something and create programs that were sustainable over the long term, because that's a more beneficial way to deliver the healthcare. So, yeah. So that's the origins, I guess.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, it starts when you're a backpacker and, yeah, this story comes about, which is pretty cool. So I guess then, like you said, you know, you tried to make it more sustainable. Where did that lead you to? So you've gone from having backpacks with medical supplies and providing care and transporting those that, you know, actually need some further medical care. How did you make that more sustainable and have, you know, potentially, I don't know, was it clinics? How did you go about it?
Yeah, so we hooked up with an organisation in Nepal that that ran a school and an orphanage, and they wanted to develop some medical programs in the regions where they grew up, which is essentially the eastern part of Nepal, kind of halfway between Everest and the India border, if you think of that area there. And their idea was that we essentially build a health center, which was quite daunting for us. We didn't really know how to go about it. Didn't really know how to fundraise and to build and to, you know, engage the local community and all that kind of things. So essentially, in the early days, we started by doing a number of health clinics and camps in the village that we're working in, which is called Keta Sagara, in the Okodunga district, for anyone that's listening that's been to Nepal. So we started by doing a bunch of different clinics over there, basically doing health checks and getting a baseline of what was needed in the community. And then over the next two or so years, we fundraised and also put volunteer groups through the community to try and get them used to having foreigners over there. This village that we worked in, I was the first foreigner that had been there ever.
Wow.
So it took them a little while to kind of get their heads around Western medicine and all that kind of thing. So over those 2 years, we gradually fundraised. We ran an annual fundraiser back in Perth called Organised Chaos, which is exactly what it sounds like. It was just an urban adventure race that we used to promote what we're doing and also raise funds. And then over those 2 years, we gradually got enough funds to pull the pin and build a 3-room health clinic, which we did, and that was opened in 2014. Then off the back of that health clinic, what we started to do was develop local capacity. So we put a local nurse and a local midwife into the clinic, and then we ran volunteer trips through the clinic for 14 days at a time. And that funded the clinic, but also gave the local guys some education and some training along the way. Then the next process on top of that was that we decided that we needed to service the clinic in a bunch of ways. So we developed a number of little programs. The first was the response team, which is essentially a foot ambulance. So we took 14 villagers and we trained them in basic first aid, expectation, low angle rescues because it's very steep and things like that, and basic transport and stabilization so that they could go out into the surrounding villages or down to the deeper parts of the village where we worked and transport people back to the medical center for treatment. So that worked really, really well. It's still going as far as we know. And then the next year we did a maternal health program where we trained six ladies in obstetrics and antenatal care and all that kind of thing. So those programs worked out really, really well and were quite beneficial for the community. So
that's really cool. That's really awesome that you get to, you know, give something back in terms of not just going in and providing care but actually making a difference and training up the community to be able to provide those services when you're not there, particularly in situations like this with COVID, which I'm assuming has thrown a massive spanner in your works. with it all. And so I guess, you know, what is the biggest challenge of going into another country and providing, you know, medical care? And, you know, we're going that from with the good faith in our hearts, but, you know, is there any sort of challenges that arise with that?
Yeah, look, there's logistical challenges, and you know, off the bat, like it's uncomfortable work. It's not for everyone. And we've been very, very honest about that right since the inception of Backpacker Medics. It's not for everyone. Like if you don't like sitting in a clapped out Jeep for like 30 to 40 hours on some dodgy roads and eating crap food and getting the runs and vomiting, like it's just not for you. It's just not your place. And that's cool. So, I mean, delivering care, it starts with those challenges and the logistics of it. But honestly, the part of the biggest challenge is local interaction and acceptance of Western medicine. So, you know, you think you know a little bit about humans, right? When you study and you spend all this time working how the body works, and then you go somewhere and like Nepal, or it could be a bunch of different countries where we've worked, and you realize that their understanding of the way humans work is completely off the charts compared to what we think. So quite often the biggest challenge was creating trust to engage them on a deeper level so that they would engage with the medicine, I guess. So when it came to those clinics that we would run, or running volunteer groups through the community for long periods of times, that's essentially what it, well, even building the health center in Nepal, that's essentially what it was all about, is creating trust. So the community kind of learns to trust the medicine a little bit. They have a very high reliance on witch doctors and things like that traditionally. So for us, the idea was just to create that trust, build that, and then hopefully they will accept kind of some of the treatments that we had for them. Yeah. I remember once treating an older lady, like probably 60 to 70 years old, had a little bit of a chest rattle, and you know, she was fine. She just had a respiratory infection. And we were talking through, you know, how we're going to treat it and how she takes the medicine that we gave her and rah, rah. And then all this was done through an interpreter, of course. And then I said, you know, do you have any other questions? Is there anything else that you want to know? And she looked up to the wall, and there was one of those anatomy pictures. It had a bunch of anatomy, like posters that you'll see around, you know, the bones, the musculoskeletal system. So she looks up at the poster of all the muscles on the wall with the human standing there, all the muscles exposed. And she points to the guy and she goes, "That guy there, is he still alive?" So that was a bit of an eye opener in terms of like how they view what we're bringing them, what kind of medicine we're bringing. They just have no concept of the way we think about stuff.
Absolutely. Well, I was even reading one of the blogs on your site about how a young boy had broken his arm, and, you know, they realized that, you know, they potentially needed surgery, and it was quite straightforward, just such a normal surgery that would occur here. But the trust was such an issue that, you know, the parents didn't want that to happen, and you had to go through a big process of, you know, trying to get an interpreter to basically convince and build that trust to make that go ahead and actually, like, you know, make a difference in this kid's life. So that was pretty interesting to read. And I guess, how do you build that trust? What are the strategies that you guys utilize to try and do that when you're going into a foreign country?
Yeah, drink lots of tea. Honestly, it's like, I mean, in the early stages when we started working in the village that we decided to focus on, it was simple. Like I mean, in the first 3 months that I spent there, I probably touched like 10 patients. It wasn't about that. It was more about sitting down and learning about how they live, what's important to them, you know, how they interact with different families. It's a caste system, so who has the respect and who doesn't and how that works and all that kind of thing. So in the early days, it was literally just sitting down and talking and listening. Then as we kind of moved on, it was more about showing up, gaining trust by showing up. So that's part of the reason why we actually build a physical clinic, but also just making sure that we go there every month so that they come to expect that people are going to come and look after them and they can have that kind of care. And, you know, it was once you've gained that trust, once you gain that respect, it's less about the medicine you deliver for them, and it's more about the fact that you're a regular presence and they trust you in that way. I guess one of the biggest things that we did right from the beginning was a daily kids health and hygiene session. So every single morning at 7 a.m., all the kids in the village would come to the health clinic and we'd run, do a little bit of English and dancing and all that kind of thing to warm up, but we run toothbrushing, hand washing and general hygiene sessions every single morning. And that really instilled I guess some belief in their parents that we were going to be around for a while because we're instilling our knowledge into the future generation. But it also made those kids understand the benefits of what we're trying to achieve. So you'd be sitting there and you'd see a 4 or 5 year old kid walking along with his mum, giving her a lesson on how to wash her hands and things like that. And that's when things ticked and they're like, oh, maybe we are making a little bit of a difference here.
That's awesome. That's really cool. And I guess then, like, did you see yourself when you, sorry, it's a little bit askew, but did you see yourself ever working, you know, in this sort of humanitarian sort of side of paramedicine rather than being on, you know, an ambulance on road? Because this is quite a stark difference to what we expect when you start the degree. So it's pretty awesome.
Well, I think, like most people, you want to be on the chopper, right? When you start your degree, that's what most people aspire to. You want to do all the big, sexy jobs. But the truth of the matter is, and anyone that's in their degree has done placements and things like that, the truth is that you know that that's maybe less than 1% of the real work, right?
Definitely.
I guess for me, in terms of my career, like inverted commas, as a paramedic, like probably the worst thing I could have done was start Backpacker Medics, because it gave me a perspective on not to be too negative about it, but a little bit about how the health system in Australia is abused sometimes, you know. So you'd be treating a patient who's really, really, really sick in a village that's just so far from anywhere, in some far-flung country, and they've hesitated to come and see you for like 2 or 3 days because they didn't want to be a bother or blah, blah, blah. And then you come back and go straight on road and you get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning for some bloke who's had a toothache for 8 weeks and can't be bothered to go to the dentist in his own time. You know what I mean? So that kind of juxtaposition was really quite stark for me, especially in the early stages of my career. So I guess in terms of broadening my mind, it was fantastic because then I started to think, well, maybe there's different ways that we can approach this profession.
Absolutely. And I guess we spoke a little bit off air, but basically now that the profession is registered as well, there's so many opportunities and avenues in which you can take it. You know, it's opened up your mind to a lot of different things doing this sort of work in terms of paramedicine. We were talking to someone recently who they did some work in like Greek refugee camps and stuff, and just getting out, they mentioned that just getting out of the bubble of what they're usually living in, because like Australia, you live in a pretty sheltered life, like in terms of, you know, what goes on in the world. How did you find that for you? Like, you know, sort of getting out of your comfort zone and experiencing something different.
Yeah, it was a huge wake up call for me. Like, I guess, Once you get a few years into your career, also, like, you get fairly comfortable with the workplace. You know, when you're in an ambulance, you start, you know, I'm on top of this stuff. I know my CPGs. I know this. I know that. But when you're working in these places, it's like, throw all that out the window. Like, you're not dealing with CPR. You're not dealing with, you know, any kind of, well, sometimes you might, but you're generally not dealing with acute type stuff that you might get called for in Australia. You're dealing with skin infections and, you know, chronic presentations, or, you know, sore knees and things like that. So you're actually broadening your knowledge base a little bit too. So in that respect, it was fantastic. And it kind of drove me to, yeah, just to start to think about things a little bit differently. What I guess I learned, especially in the kind of early days of Backpacker Medics, taking groups of like 8 volunteers at a time, like up to 8 volunteers at a time, plus interpreters and all that kind of things, is that delivery of good medical care, particularly in remote areas, is probably 80% logistics and 20% the actual care and knowledge, because getting there, being able to provide the right materials in the right space, all that kind of thing, is really, really important. Keeping people safe, you know.
What would be the most out of the box type of thing that you've had to deal with when you've been doing this type of work, you know, in comparison to being in Australia or doing something like that? Like, what types of skills have you needed to, upskill or do anything to try and basically tailor your care to what you're doing?
There's a lot of like weird individual cases that come to mind. Honestly, the biggest upskilling that I had to do, and like the learning's never finished, right? But the biggest upskilling that I had to do was in the area of skin disease and presentations and things like that, because particularly when we're working in Nepal, maybe not so much now that we do disaster focused stuff, but particularly when we're working in Nepal, they live a very harsh life, and a lot of their presentations are to do with skin problems, which for most paramedics is just completely foreign.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you study it at a very, very superficial level, and then it's pretty much cast aside, and you just take those people on to higher care, don't you? So, not to say that I have any, like, I'm probably at level 2 deeper understanding than anyone else, you know what I mean? Because it's such a wide field, but it was a really big eye opener for me. Like, you would see 10 patients in a day. Maybe 7 of them will come with some kind of weird and wonderful skin complaint. So I guess that recurring problem for me led us down the path of actually setting up things like a clinical committee and also a phone a friend type system, where we can have clinicians on standby back here in Australia that we can contact if we have questions about those things. So things like WhatsApp and you know, other chat services have been fantastic for that, particularly in the last kind of 4 or 5 years.
That's awesome. And I guess then, what types of skills do people gain, or what are the benefits that they get from going out and doing the type of work that you guys have been doing?
Yeah, I think in the early days, but when we were working in Nepal, people will gain a lot more primary care scope, you know. So if that was something that you were interested in, like kind of community medicine type area, that was a big plus for people. When we changed our model in 2017-18 to the more disaster response type stuff, really what people are going to gain now from a deployment is mass casualty type stuff. So for example, when we went to Bangladesh for the Rohingya refugee crisis, we were talking about, you know, 200, 300, 400 patients a day for a small team. Some of them, especially in the early stages, just walking in with gunshot wounds and necrotic infections and hypothermia from swimming across the water and this kind of thing. And each one just getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, you know. So that's a real skill that people gain from that kind of work. And I guess that the two things are kind of opposite ends of the spectrum in some sense.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds absolutely, you know, phenomenal. Like, you know, up to 400 patients a day, whereas when you're on the road now, you potentially get up to maybe 8 patients in a 12-hour period. Which is pretty interesting. Like, what made you guys change from going from your old model to more of a disaster response sort of model?
There was a few key things that happened. Probably the first and most important thing was the Nepal earthquake. So that was 2015. Obviously, we've been working there for a number of years. And we didn't have anyone on the ground at the time of the earthquake. But because of our connections there and we thought of all of our interpreters, friends, helpers, village community, we thought of all them as family. We just felt compelled to go. So we developed a really small team. There was 8 of us. We had 1 logistics staff and the rest medics. And our idea was to go there completely self-sufficiently and to do what we could. As it turned out, that was a really, really awesome model. We just happened upon it by no design whatsoever. But the model of self-sufficiency and being there in the very early stages of a disaster is something that we've hung on to and has turned out to be really effective. So so you think of things like Red Cross, Medicine Sans Frontier, those bigger organisations. They have rapid response units and like they are awesome at what they do. Like those guys can set up a field hospital with X-ray imaging blah, 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 in like 2 weeks. It's amazing what they can do. But in those very early stages of responses, they're just not agile enough to get into the field and to be self-sufficient and things like that. And that's where we, after Nepal, we found that we fit really well. So the other factor was that we were getting to a point in Nepal where the community was becoming a little bit more self-sufficient. The training that we put into the local staff, the local health service, a few things changed after the earthquake too. There was they put a bit more effort into transport to the areas so that the Japanese government put a lot of money into roads and things like that. So a few things changed where we thought, oh, maybe it's time to change things up and move our focus to disaster response. So we did. We handed over all our operations in Nepal to the local government, the health service, and we reassessed our focus and put it back towards the disaster response stuff. So, yeah.
That's awesome. And like, obviously, you have to be able to adapt to, you know, what the needs are. And, like, what does a post-disaster response look like? Like, you just said, like, you get into those early stages, but what does it actually comprise of for our listeners that are unsure?
Chaos. Look, it's completely different for everything that we've been to. So Nepal was... yeah, Nepal's chaotic at the best of times. And honestly, like this isn't trying to be funny or anything, but sometimes in the early stages of the Nepal earthquake, you'd be driving around and you weren't quite sure if a building had fallen down because of earthquake or it was like that when we were there 6 months ago. So, but definitely chaos is the first thing that is always there. you know. But if it's a natural earthquake versus a man-made problem, so something like the Rohingya response was a man-made problem, and I guess internally you process things differently. Yeah. Nepal was quite emotional for everyone that went, because we'd all been there and worked there before, and we obviously had connections. But there was no one to blame, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, definitely.
When we went to Bangladesh, when we went to Bangladesh, there was probably the emotions that you had to get over about what was happening to the Rohingya people was probably the very first thing that you had to, the first obstacle that you had to get over. Like you've seen people with gunshot wounds in their feet or in their backsides and things like that. And you just, when you start to think about how that actually happens, like we've got quite a few guys that were ex-military and SAS and things like that, and explaining how the only way that that could happen, start to think about those things, and these really strong emotions come up about why this is happening to people, and you know, all that kind of thing. So I guess apart from the chaos, like putting your own emotions aside and putting your own concerns aside for safety and things like that are things that you have to get over in the initial stages.
Absolutely, that's a really big point. Definitely. And I guess from there, like, what can students start to do, or graduates even start to do, to, you know, get involved in, you know, these sorts of projects, you know, outside of state ambulance service, or just starting to get involved and learn more about it?
Yeah. But honestly, I mean, our selection processes have developed quite substantially over the last few years. Not because we're trying to be hoity-toity and snooty about who we take. That's definitely not the case. The reason why we've kind of made it more selective is because we don't want people to be in situations that might affect them adversely going through their career. We want the right people in the field, you know, for the right response. Honestly, the biggest things that we value are flexibility and kind of worldliness. That's a kind of overarching term, and it sounds a bit wishy-washy, but if you think, like, you know, travel, exposure to different cultures, experience in the outdoors, flexibility in those kind of areas, because when we deploy, we are always ready to sleep in the field if we have to. We're doing days that might start at 4 a.m. and finish at 11 p.m. you know, you might not get food, or you've got a couple of muesli bars or something like that to last you that whole day. So you got to be okay with sleeping in the dirt. You got to be okay with, you know, being uncomfortable. You got to be open to different cultures. You know, you got to be okay with different foods. Yeah, it sounds strange that we're talking about like medical response, but they're but those are the important things. They really are. Like, when it comes down to it, the majority of the work that you're presented with, you can always get your head around, or you can always refer to someone else in the team, or you can always ask to hire the support that we have. But you can't deal with long car trips, or you can't deal with crappy food, or you can't deal with lack of sleep, then you've got problems.
Absolutely. Well, that's a really good point. And so I guess, well, as much as, you know, that's a main component as well. You know, before, when you were even talking about how in Nepal to build that trust, you know, you really had to be able to sit down with people, communicate, just, you know, be patient as well. It's really interesting because the way you mentioned it is such a long-term thing. You know, it took a while to build that trust. And it's funny because, you know, it's those basic principles that we learn, you know, that are important to be a paramedic or in any sort of healthcare job, that, you know, we have to do it within a few minutes of meeting someone on road over here. Whereas you really had to take that time and that patience to just build that foundation. I think that's really incredible.
Yeah. And look, I guess, you know, when you're talking about disaster response, I guess the more acute the problem, the quicker you can build trust, because, you know, people need need help or whatever it is. But I think if you're talking about long-term projects, yeah, it's probably the most fundamentally important thing that we do as an organization. So for example, in Bangladesh, in the Rohingya response, we actually had three responses, and each of them was slightly different in their own way. The first one was literally on the ground in the first 24, 36 hours. And that was a pure mass casualty response. The guys were just getting people walking through the door endlessly with really horrific injuries in really bad conditions. The second response was more of a primary care type response. So the refugee villages were starting to fill up a lot more, and they were getting like re-presentations and infection issues and things like that. People were reticent to access the health services that had been set up, or they couldn't because they were had to look after kids or things like that. So that response was slightly different. And then the third response was partly a primary care response from our part, but also a training. So what we did was we trained 40, I can't remember the exact number, but we trained around 40 refugees, essentially the way that we did for the village in Nepal: basic first aid, stabilization, transport techniques, how to access health services. So for each of the segments within the refugee camps, they were able to provide that basic service for their area. And I guess, like, we wouldn't have been able to do that if we didn't work through each step of the process, gaining trust along the way. So in the very first days, we had some interpreters, and those interpreters then started to talk to local leaders within the camps, and those leaders became to recognize us. And then when they saw us come back again, they're like, "Oh, I know you. Yeah, come on, let's go and do this." And they'd help us do it. So by the third time we came around, they were setting up our teaching area. It was right next to the mosque, which was hard. So a few times a day you'd be teaching and you'd have this massive wailing going on next to you. But, you know, they were clearing areas for us to teach in. They were standing around making sure the kids didn't come in and disrupt us. So I guess, yeah, you can build that trust in different ways. But
yeah, that's absolutely awesome. Really insightful. And, like, I've really loved, you know, listening to you talk about all the different ways that you've gone about things, and it's quite eye-opening as to where we can take our paramedic degrees, and I think that's really phenomenal. So I do want to go through the last three questions with you, which are the ones that we ask everyone, just to get, you know, everyone's perspectives on these same questions. So the first one is, what is one piece of advice that you'd give to a student?
Don't neglect the other 50% of the job. When you're at uni particularly, and also in the first couple of years of your degree, I guess, or a graduate, you learn all the medical stuff, all the AMP and all that kind of thing. But to be honest, that's only 50% of the job, isn't it? The other 50% of the time, you might be the driver, or you might be the eyes and ears for the person who's attending, or you might be working out logistics and all that kind of thing. It's a really, really, really important part of the job. Yeah. Anyone that's worked on road or done clinical placements will know that, like, to have a really supportive driver, partner, whatever way you want to put it, is really, really important. So for me, that's not only driving in terms of being behind the wheel, but actually thinking spatially, thinking about safety, thinking about, you know, being dynamic and flexible and all that kind of thing. And particularly, like, if you want to go branch out and do the kind of work that we do, like, that's, you know, that turns into 80% of the job.
Absolutely, I love that. And the second one is, what has been your biggest mistake that's resulted in your greatest learning?
Yeah, I think in terms of working in the humanitarian area, I I asked a mum of a patient, so I was a little toddler. I asked the mum of a patient to collect a stool sample for me, with the kid, to work out what was going, see if we could work out what was going on in their gut, at least have a look at it and that kind of thing. And I guess the lesson I learned from this was that you have to be very specific, because people in developing countries, maybe it's a society thing, I don't know, but they take things very literally. So I asked for that stool sample at, midday. I woke up at like 5 a.m. the next morning, and she was sitting there at the door where I came out of my room where I was staying with a stool sample. And the first thing I saw in the morning was a stool sample pushed into my face right in front of my eyes. And I guess like after that, I'm like, oh, that's great, that's fantastic. But I really need to remember that you have to be explicit about things. You have to be really careful about how you explain things, and yeah, quite literally, things are going to happen like that if you're not very specific about them.
That's an awesome communication learning. I love that. And the last one is, what did you used to believe to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
This is going to sound really, really pessimistic, but I used to believe that like every single job that you went to was life or death. I think everyone does for the first few years of their career on road. You always have those heart palpitations when you're like, oh, another job's come up. I used to believe that, but I guess with hindsight, you work out that, you know, people get sick, and there's a very, very large degree of differences in that sickness. That's not to say, though, that every person that you see doesn't deserve your full and undivided attention. Yeah. But so, for me, the greatest learnings, and particularly when I had like on-road students and things like that, for me, the greatest learnings always came from the low acuity patients, those little nanas that, you know, you have to sit there and listen to whilst you took them into hospital. That's where you learn your basic skills. That's where you learn what, you know, sick versus not sick or something like that.
That's awesome. That's a really good perspective. I really like that. It's a really good thing to learn sort of early on too. Especially for like our first year or even second year students. But I've absolutely loved having a chat to you today about what you've done and Backpacker Medics. And just so our listeners can find you, whereabouts can they look up more about you and Backpacker Medics?
Don't look up me. That's probably not a good Google. Backpackermedics.org. You can go to our website. You can find us on Instagram and all around. I'll be quite honest and say that Backpacker Medics is only what it is because of the people that gravitate towards it. Yeah, look, I founded it, I started it, but that means nothing because of the volunteers that we have is what made it what it is over the years, and also the core group that we have now. So if you're interested in going into this kind of area, it's not for everyone, like I said in the beginning, but if you're interested, you think it might be something that you want to do, get in contact with us and we can kind of lay out a bit of a pathway for you that one day you might be suitable for a deployment with us.
That's awesome. Well, that'll be incredible for anyone that's listening to this and wants to get on board with that. So thank you so much. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.